Everything that was, except for the book snake. That remained, dozing in the long, empty main room, the hot main room, now that the air conditioners had been removed. Even with the skylights open in the daytime and a couple of fans to keep the air circulating, it was hot. And why wouldn't it be? The place was nothing but a glorified barn loft with a literary pedigree. Then there were those ugly maroon smudges on the carpet, the oyster-white carpet that couldn't be taken up until the book snake was gone. She'd dismissed the stains as careless slops of woodcoat varnish when Canty asked about them, but Amanda knew better, and Lisi had an idea that Darla might have a few suspicions as well. The carpet had to go, but the books had to go first, and Lisi wasn't quite ready to dispose of them. Just why, she wasn't sure. Maybe only because they were the last of Scott's things still up there, the very last of him. So she waited. 2. On the third day of the sisters' cleaning binge, Deputy Beckman called to tell Lisi that an abandoned PT cruiser with Delaware plates had been found in a gravel pit on the Stackpole Church Road, about 3 miles from her house. Would Lisi come down to the sheriff's office and take a look? They had it back in the parking lot, the deputy said, where they kept the impounds and a few drug rides, whatever they were. Lisi went with Amanda. Neither Darla nor Canty was much interested. All they knew was that a kook had been sniffing around, making a pest of himself about Scott's papers. Kooks were nothing new in their sister's life. Over the years of Scott's celebrity, any number of them had been drawn to him like moths to a bug light. The most famous, of course, had been Cole. Neither Lisi nor Amanda had said anything to give Darla and Canty the idea that this was one in Cole's class. Certainly there was no mention of the dead cat in the mailbox, and Lisi had been at some pains to impress discretion on the sheriff's deputies as well. The car in stall 7 was a PT cruiser, no more and no less. Beige in color, nondescript once you got past the slightly flamboyant body type. It could have been the one Lisi saw as she drove home from Greenlawn on that long, long Thursday. It could have been one of several thousand others. This was what she told Deputy Beckman, reminding him that she'd seen it coming almost directly out of the setting sun. He nodded sadly. What she knew in her heart was that it was the one. She could smell Dooley on it. She thought, I am going to hurt you places you didn't let the boys to touch at the junior high dances, and had to repress a shiver. It's a stolen car, isn't it? Amanda asked. You bet your bippy, Beckman said. A deputy Lisi didn't know strolled over. He was tall, probably 6.5 feet. It seemed a rule that these men should be tall. Broad-shouldered, too. He introduced himself as Deputy Andy Clutterbuck and shook Lisi's hand. Ah, she said, the acting sheriff. His smile was brilliant. Nope, Norris is back. He's in court this afternoon, but he's back all right. I'm just plain old Deputy Clutterbuck again. Congratulations. This is my sister, Amanda DeBuscher. Clutterbuck shook Amanda's hand. Pleased, Ms. DeBuscher. Then to both of them. That car was stolen out of a shopping mall in Laurel, Maryland. He stared at it, thumbs hooked in his belt. Did you know that in France, they call PT cruisers Le Car Jimmy Cagney? Amanda seemed unimpressed by this information. Were there fingerprints? Nary a one, he said, wiped clean. Plus, whoever was driving it took the cover off the dome light and broke the bulb. What do you think of that? I think it sounds beaucoup suspicious, Amanda said. Clutterbuck laughed. Yeah, but there's a retired carpenter in Delaware who's going to be very happy to get his car back, busted dome light and all. Lisi said, Have you found out anything about Jim Dooley? That would be John Doolin, Mrs. Landon, born in Shooter's Knob, Tennessee. Moved to Nashville at age 5 with his family, then went to live with his aunt and uncle in Moundsville, West Virginia, when his parents and older sister were killed in a fire in the winter of 1974. Doolin was then age 9. The official cause of the deaths was down to defective Christmas tree lights, but I talked to a retired detective who worked that case. He said there was some suspicion the boy might have had something to do with it. No proof. Lisi saw no reason to pay close attention to the rest, because whatever he called himself, her persecutor was never coming back from the place where she had taken him. Yet she did hear Clutterbuck say that Doolin had spent a good many years in a Tennessee mental institution. And she continued to believe that he had met Gerd Allan Cole there and caught Cole's obsession, ding-dong for the Freesias, like a virus. Scott had had a queer saying, one Lisey had never fully understood until the business of McCool Dooley Doolin. Some things just have to be true, Scott said, because they have no other choice. In any case, you want to keep your eyes peeled for the guy, Clutterbuck told the two women, and if it looks like he's still around. Or takes some time off and then decides to come back, Beckman put in. Clutterbuck nodded. Yep, that's a possibility, too. If he shows up again, I think we ought to have a meeting with your family, Mrs. Landon. Put them all in the picture. Do you agree? If he shows up, we'll certainly do that, Lisey said. She spoke seriously, almost solemnly, but on their way out of town, she and Amanda indulged in a bout of hysterical laughter at the idea of Jim Dooley ever showing up again. 3. An hour or two before dawn the next morning, shuffling into the bathroom with one eye open, thinking of nothing but peeing and going back to bed, Lisey thought she saw something moving in the bedroom behind her. That brought her awake in a hurry and turning on her heels. There was nothing there. She took a hand towel from the rod beside the sink and hung it over the medicine cabinet mirror in which she'd seen the movement, wedging the towel carefully until it would stay on its own. Then, and only then, did she finish her business. She was sure Scott would have understood. 4. The summer slipped by, and one day Lisey noticed that school supply signs had appeared in the windows of several stores on Castle Rock's Main Street. And why not? It was suddenly half past August. Scott's study was, except for the book snake and the stained white carpet upon which it dozed, waiting for the next thing. If there was a next thing, Lisey had begun to consider the possibility of putting the house up for sale. Canty and Rich threw their annual Midsummer Night's Dream Party on August 14th. Lisey set out to get righteously smashed on Rich Lawler's Long Island iced tea, a thing she hadn't done since Scott had died. She asked Rich for a double to get started, then set it down untasted on one of the caterer's tables. She thought she had seen something moving either on the surface of the glass, as if reflected there, or deep within the amber depths, as if swimming there. It was utter shite, of course, but she found her urge to get absolutely stinko was gone. In truth, she wasn't sure she dared to get drunk, or even high. Wasn't sure she dared to let her defenses down in such a way. Because if she had attracted the long boy's attention, if it was watching her from time to time, or even just thinking about her, well. Part of her was sure that was crap. Part of her was positive it wasn't. As August waned and the hottest weather of the summer rolled into New England, testing tempers and the Northeast power grid, something even more distressing began happening to Lisey. Except, like the things she sometimes thought she might be glimpsing in certain reflective surfaces, she wasn't entirely sure it was happening at all. Sometimes she'd flounder up from sleep in the mornings, an hour or maybe two before her usual time, gasping and covered with sweat, even with the air conditioning on, feeling as she had when coming out of nightmares as a child, that she hadn't really escaped the grip of whatever had been after her, that it was still under the bed and would curl its cold, distorted hand around her ankle or reach right up through her pillow and grab her by the neck. During these panicky wakings, she would run her hands over the sheets and then up to the head of her bed before opening her eyes, wanting to be sure, absolutely sure, that she wasn't, well, somewhere else. Because once you stretch those tendons, she sometimes thought, opening her eyes and looking at her familiar bedroom with great and inexpressible relief, it's ever so much easier to do it next time. And she had stretched a certain set of tendons, hadn't she? Yes, first by yanking Amanda, then by yanking Dooley. She had stretched them but good. It seemed to her that after she'd awakened half a dozen times and discovered she was right where she belonged, in the bedroom that had once been hers and Scott's and now was hers alone, matters should have improved, but they didn't. They got worse instead. She felt like a loose tooth in a sick socket. And then, on the first day of the big heat wave, a heat wave to match the cold snap of 10 years before, and the ironic balance of this, coincidental though it might have been, was not lost on her. What she feared finally happened. 5. She lay back on the couch in the living room just to rest her eyes for a few moments. The unquestionably idiotic but occasionally entertaining Jerry Springer was babbling away on the idiot box. My mother stole my boyfriend. My boyfriend stole my mother. Something like that. Lisi reached out to pick up the remote and shut the damn thing off, or maybe she only dreamed she did, because when she opened her eyes to see where the remote was, she was lying not on the couch, but on the hill of Lupin in Buyamun. It was full daylight, and there was no sense of danger, certainly no sense that Scott's long boy, for so she thought of it and always would, although she supposed it was her long boy now, Lisi's long boy, was near. But she was terrified nevertheless, almost to the point of screaming helplessly. Instead of doing that, she closed her eyes, visualized her living room, and suddenly she could hear the guests on the Springer show yelling at each other and feel the oblong of the remote control in her left hand. A second later, she was starting up from the couch, eyes wide and skin all a prickle. She could almost believe she had dreamed the whole deal. It certainly made sense, given her current level of anxiety on the subject. But the vividness of what she had seen in those few seconds argued against that idea, comforting as it was. So did the smear of purple on the back of the hand holding the TV controller. 6. The next day she called the Fogler Library and spoke to Mr. Bertram Partridge, the head of special collections. That gentleman grew steadily more excited as Lisi described the books still remaining in Scott's study. He called them associational volumes and said Fogler Special Collections would be very happy to have them and to work with her on the tax credit question. Lisi said that would be very nice, just as though she had been asking herself the tax credit question for years. Mr. Partridge said he would send a team of removers out the very next day to box the volumes up and bring them the 120 miles to the University of Maine's Orono campus. Lisi reminded him that the weather was supposed to be very hot and that Scott's study, which was no longer air-conditioned, had reverted to its former loftish nature. Perhaps, she said, Mr. Partridge would like to hold his removers in abeyance until cooler weather. Not at all, Mrs. Landon, Partridge said, chuckling expansively, and Lisi knew he was afraid she might change her mind if given too long to think the matter over. I've got a couple of young folks in mind who'll be perfect for the job. You wait and see. 7. Less than an hour after her conversation with Bertram Partridge, Lisi's phone rang while she was making herself a tuna on rye for her supper. Thin commons, but all she wanted. Outside, the heat lay on the land like a blanket. All color had been bleached from the sky. It was a perfect simmering white from horizon to horizon. As she mixed the tuna and mayonnaise with a little chopped onion, she had been thinking of how she'd found Amanda on one of those benches, looking out at the hollyhocks, and this was strange, because she hardly ever thought of that anymore. It was like a dream to her. She remembered Amanda's asking her if she'd have to drink any of that bug juice, shitty punch if she came back. Her way of trying to find out, Lisi supposed, if she'd have to remain incarcerated at Greenlawn. And Lisi had promised her no more punch, no more bug juice. Amanda had agreed to return, although it had been clear she didn't really want to, that she would have been happy to continue sitting on the bench and looking out at the hollyhocks until, in Goodma's words, eternity was halfway over. Just sitting there among the scary shrouded things and silent gazers, a bench or two above the woman in the caftan, the one who had murdered her child. Lisi put her sandwich down on the counter, suddenly cold all over. She couldn't know that. There was no way she could know that. But she did. Be quiet, the woman had said. Be quiet while I think of why I did it. And then Amanda had said something totally unexpected, hadn't she? Something about Scott. Although nothing Amanda said then could be important now, not with Scott dead and Jim Dooley also dead, or wishing he were. But still Lisi wished she could remember exactly what it might have been. Said she'd come back, Lisi murmured. Said she'd come back if it would keep Dooley from hurting me. Yes, and Amanda had kept her word, God bless her. But Lisi wanted to remember something she'd said after that, I don't see what it can have to do with Scott, Amanda had said in that faintly distracted voice of hers. He's been dead such a long time. Although, I think he told me something about... That was when the phone rang, shattering the fragile glass of Lisi's recollection. And as she picked it up, a crazy certainty came to her. It would be Dooley.
Hello, Mrs., the Black Prince of the Inkunks would say. I'm calling from inside the belly of the beast. How y'all doing today?
Hello, she said. She knew she was gripping the phone too tightly, but was helpless to do anything about it. Danny Beckman here, Mrs. Landon, the voice at the other end said, and the Mrs. was too close for comfort, but here came out here, a comfortable Yankee pronunciation, and Deputy Beckman sounded uncharacteristically excited, almost bubbly, and therefore boyish.
Guess what?
Can't guess, Lisi said, but another crazy idea came to her. He was going to say they drew straws down at the sheriff's office to see who was going to call up and ask her out on a date, and he drew the short one. Except why would he sound excited about that?
We found the dome light cover.
Lisi had no idea what he was talking about.
I beg pardon?
Doolin, the guy you knew as Zach McCool and then as Jim Dooley, stole that PT Cruiser and used it while he was stalking you, Mrs. Landon. We were positive of that.
And he was keeping it stashed out in that old gravel pit between runs. We were positive of that, too. We just couldn't prove it because he wiped off all his fingerprints.
Yeah, and got them all. But every now and then, me and Plug went out there.
Plug?
I'm sorry, Joe, Deputy Alston.
Plug, she thought, aware for the first time in a clear-seeing way that these were real men with real lives. With nicknames. Plug, she thought. Deputy Joe Alston, also known as Plug.
Mrs. Landon, are you there?
Yes, Dan. May I call you Dan?
Sure, you bet.
Anyway, every now and then we went sniffing around out there to see if we couldn't find some prizes, because there was plenty of sign he'd spent time in that pit. Candy wrappers, couple of RC bottles, things like that.
RC, she said softly, and thought,
Bool, Dan. Bool, Plug.
Bool, the end.
Right, that was the brand name he seemed to favor, but not a single print on a single cast-off bottle matched up to one of his. The only match we got was a fella who stole a car back in the late 70s and now clerks at the Quickie Mart over at Oxford. The other prints we got off the bottles, we surmised those were clerk prints too. But yesterday noon, Mrs. Landon.
Lisi. There was a pause while he considered this. Then he went on.
Yesterday noon, Lisi, on a little track leading out of that pit, I found the grand prize. The cover to that dome light. He pulled it off and threw it into the puckies.
Beckman's voice rose, became triumphant, became not the voice of a deputy sheriff, but perfectly human.
And that was the one thing he forgot to handle with gloves on or wipe off later. A big thumbprint on one side, a big fat old index finger on the other, where he gripped it. We got the results back by fax this morning.
John Doolin?
Aye. 9 points of comparison. 9.
There was a pause, and when he spoke again, some of the triumph had gone out of his voice.
Now if we could only find the son of a buck.
I'm sure he'll turn up in time, she said, and cast a longing glance at her tuna sandwich. She'd lost her train of thought about Amanda, but had regained her appetite. To Lisi that seemed like a fair swap, especially on such a boogery hot day.
Even if he doesn't, he stopped harassing me.
He's left Castle County. I'd stake my reputation on that.
A note of unmistakable pride crept into Deputy Sheriff Dan Beckman's voice.
Got a little too hot for him here, I guess. So he ditched his ride and left. Plug feels the same. Jim Dooley and Elvis have both left the building.
Plug, is that for chewing tobacco?
No, ma'am, not at all. In high school, he and I played the line on the Castle Hill Knights team that won the Class A state championship. Bangor Rams was favored by 3 touchdowns, but we shocked them. Only team from our part of the state to win a gold football since the 1950s. And Joey, no one could stop him. Not that whole season. Even with 4 guys hanging off him, he kept plugging. So we called him Plug, and I still do. If I called him that, do you think he'd swap me?
Dan Beckman laughed, delighted.
No, he'd be tickled.
Okay, then. I'm Lisi, you're Dan, and he's Plug.
That's square John with me.
And thanks for the call. That was terrific police work.
Thanks for saying so, ma'am, Lisi.
She could hear the glow in his voice, and that made her feel good.
You be in touch now if there's anything else we can do, or if you hear from that lowlife again.
I will. Lisi went back to her sandwich with a smile on her face and didn't think about Amanda, or the good ship Hollyhocks, or Booyah Moon for the rest of the day. That night, however, she awoke to the sound of distant thunder and a sense that something vast was not hunting her exactly. It wouldn't bother, but musing on her. The idea that she should be in such a thing's unknowable mind made her feel like crying and like screaming at the same time. It also made her want to sit up watching movies on TCM, smoking cigarettes and drinking high-tension coffee, or beer. Beer might be better. Beer might call back sleep. Instead of getting up, she turned off the bedside lamp and lay still. I'll never go back to sleep, she thought. I'll just lie here like this until it gets light in the east. Then I can get up and make the coffee I want now. But 3 minutes after having this thought, she was dozing. 10 minutes later, she was sleeping deeply. Later still, when the moon rose and she dreamed of floating over a certain exotic beach of fine white sand on the Pillsbury magic carpet, her bed was for a few moments empty, and the room filled with the smells of frangipani and jasmine and night-blooming cereus, scents that were somehow longing and terrible at the same time. But then she was back, and in the morning Lisi barely remembered her dream of flying, her dream of flying across the beach at the edge of the pool in Booyah Moon. 8. As it happened, Lisi's vision of dismantling the book snake varied in only 2 respects from what she had foreseen, and these were minor variations indeed. First, one half of Mr. Partridge's 2-person team turned out to be a girl, a strapping 20-something with a caramel-colored ponytail threaded through the back of a Red Sox cap. Second, Lisi hadn't guessed how quickly the job would be done. In spite of the study's fearsome heat, not even 3 fans turning at top speed could do much about it. All the books were packed away in a dark blue UMO van in less than an hour. When Lisi asked the 2 librarians from Special Collections, who called themselves, only half-jokingly, Lisi thought, the minions of Partridge, if they'd like iced tea, they agreed enthusiastically and put away 2 large glasses each. The girl was Corey. She was the one who told Lisi how much she liked Scott's books, especially Relics, which she claimed to have read 3 times. The boy was Mike, and he was the one who said that they were very sorry for her loss. Lisi thanked them both for their kindness and meant it.
It must make you sad, seeing it so empty, Corey said, and tipped her glass toward the barn.
The ice cubes clinked in it. Lisi was careful not to look directly at the glass, lest she see something besides ice in there.
It's a little sad, but it's freeing, too, she said. I put off the job of cleaning it out for too long. My sisters helped me. I'm glad we did it.
More tea, Corey?
No, thanks, but could I use your bathroom before we start back?
Of course, through the living room, first door on the right. Corey excused herself. Absently, almost absently, Lisi moved the girl's glass behind the brown plastic iced tea pitcher.
Another glass, Mike?
No, thanks, he said. You'll be taking up the carpet, too, I guess.
She laughed self-consciously.
Yes, pretty bad, isn't it? From Scott's 1 experiment in wood staining, it was a disaster.
Thinking, sorry, honey.
Looks a little like dried blood, Mike said, and finished his iced tea.
The sun, hazy and hot, ran across the surface of his glass, and for a moment an eye seemed to peer out of it at Lisi. When he set it down, she had to restrain an urge to snatch it and hide it behind the plastic pitcher with the other one.
Everybody says that, she agreed.
World's worst shaving cut, Mike said and laughed.
They both laughed. Lisi thought hers sounded almost as natural as his. She didn't look at his glass.
She didn't think about the long boy that was now her long boy. She thought about nothing but the long boy.
"Sure you won't have a little more?" she asked.
"Better not. I'm driving," Mike said, and then they had another laugh.
Corey came back, and Lisi thought Mike would also ask to use the bathroom, but he didn't. Guys had bigger kidneys, bigger bladders, bigger somethings, or so Scott had claimed. And Lisi was glad, because that meant only the girl gave her that funny look before they drove away with the disassembled book snake in the back of the van.
Oh, she undoubtedly told Mike what she saw in the living room and found in the bathroom, told him on the long drive north to the University of Maine at Orono, but Lisi wasn't there to hear it. The girl's look wasn't so bad, come to that, because Lisi hadn't known what it meant at the time, although she had patted the side of her head, thinking maybe her hair had fallen funny across her ear or was standing up or something. Then, later, after popping the iced tea glasses into the dishwasher without so much as a look at them, she'd gone to use the bathroom herself and saw the towel hanging across the mirror in there. She remembered putting the hand towel over the medicine cabinet mirror upstairs, remembered blinding that one perfectly well. But when had she done this one? Lisi didn't know. She went back to the living room and saw there was a sheet hung in a swag over the mirror above the mantel as well. She should have noticed that on her way through. She imagined Corey had. It was pretty smucking obvious. But the truth was, little Lisi Landon didn't spend much time studying her own reflection these days. She did a walk-through and discovered all but two of the mirrors on the ground floor had been sheeted, toweled, or in one case, taken down and turned to the wall. The last two survivors she now covered as well, in the spirit of in for a penny, in for a pound. As she did them, Lisi wondered exactly what the young librarian in the fashionable pink Red Sox baseball cap had thought. That the famous writer's widow was either Jewish or had adopted the Jewish custom of mourning, and that her mourning still continued? That she had decided Kurt Vonnegut was right, that mirrors weren't reflective surfaces but leaks, portholes to another dimension? And really, wasn't that what she did think? Not portholes, windows. And do I have to care what some librarian from Mu Yu thinks? Oh, probably not. But there were so many reflective surfaces in a life, weren't there? Not just mirrors. There were juice glasses to avoid glancing in first thing in the morning, and wine glasses not to peer into at sundown. There were so many times when you sat behind the wheel of your car and saw your own face looking back at you from the dashboard instruments. So many long nights when the mind of something other might turn to a person, if that person could not keep her mind from turning to it. And how exactly did you keep from doing that? How did you not think of something? The mind was a high-kicking, kilt-wearing rebel, to quote the late Scott Landon. It could get up to, well, shit fire and save your matches, why not say it? It could get up to such bad gunky. And there was something else, too. Something even more frightening. Maybe if it didn't come to you, you wouldn't be able to help going to it. Because once you stretched those smucking tendons, once your life in the real world started to feel like a loose tooth in a sick socket. She'd be walking downstairs or getting into the car, or turning on the shower, or reading a book, or opening a crossword magazine, and there would be a feeling absurdly like an oncoming sneeze. Mein Gott, baby love. Mein Gott, little Lisi. An approaching orgasm, and she would think, oh, smuck, I'm not coming. I'm going. I'm going over. The world would seem to waver, and there would be that sense of a whole other world waiting to be born, one where the sweetness curdled and turned to poison after dark. A world that was just a sidestep away, no more than a flick of a hand or the turn of a hip. For a moment she would feel Castle View drop away on every side, and she would be Lisi on a tightrope, Lisi walking a knife edge. Then she'd be back again, a solid, if middle-aged and a little too thin, woman in a solid world, walking down a flight of stairs, slamming a car door, adjusting the hot water, turning the page of a book, or solving eight across. Old-style gift, four-letter word, starts with B, ends with N. 9. Two days after the dismantled book snake went north, on what the Portland branch of the National Weather Service would record as the hottest day of the year in Maine and New Hampshire,
Lisi went up to the empty study with a boombox and a compact disc titled Hank Williams' Greatest Hits. There would be no problem playing the CD, just as there had been no problem running the fans on the day the minions of Partridge had been up here. All Dooley had done, it turned out, was open the electrical box downstairs and flip off the three breakers that controlled the study's power. Lisi had no idea how hot it actually was in the study, but knew it had to be a triple-digit number. She could feel her blouse begin sticking to her body and her face dampening as soon as she was at the top of the stairs. Somewhere she had read that women don't sweat, they glow, and what a crock of shit that was. If she stayed up here long, she'd probably pass out with heatstroke, but she didn't intend to stay up here for long. There was a country song she sometimes heard on the radio called Ain't Livin' Long Like This. She didn't know who had written that song or sang it, not old Hank, but she could relate to it. She couldn't spend the rest of her life afraid of her own reflection or what she might see peeking out from behind it, and she couldn't live it afraid that she might at any moment lose her hold on reality and find herself in Booyah Moon. This shite had to end. She plugged in the boombox, then sat cross-legged on the floor before it and put in the disc. Sweat ran into her eyes, stinging, and she knuckled it away. Scott had played a lot of music up here, really blasting it out. When you had a $12,000 stereo system and soundproofing in the alcove where most of the speakers were, you really could let it rip. The first time he played Rockaway Beach for her, she'd thought the very roof over their heads might lift off. What she was about to play would sound tinny and small by comparison, but she thought it would be enough. Old Style Gift, four letters, begins with B, ends with N. Amanda, sitting on one of those benches, looking out at South Wind Harbor, sitting above the child-murdering woman in the caftan. Amanda saying, "It was something about a story. Your story. Lisi's story. And the Afghan, only he called it the African. Did he say it was a boop? A beep? A boon?" "No, Amanda, not a boon. Although that is a four-letter word, now rather old-fashioned, beginning with B and ending with N, that means gift. But the word Scott used..." That word had been bool, of course. The sweat ran down Lisi's face like tears. She let it. "As in bool, the end. And at the end you get a prize. Sometimes a candy bar. Sometimes an RC from Muley's. Sometimes a kiss. And sometimes a story. Right, honey?" Talking to him felt all right, because he was still here. Even with the computers gone and the furniture and the fancy Swedish stereo system and the file cabinets full of manuscripts and the stacks of galleys, his own and those sent to him by friends and admirers, and the book snake, even with those things gone, she still felt Scott. Of course she did, because he hadn't finished having his say. He had one more story to tell. Lisi's story. She thought she knew which one, because there was only one he had never finished. She touched one of the dried bloodstains on the carpet and thought about the arguments against insanity, the ones that fell through with the soft shurring sound. She thought how it had been under the yum-yum tree, like being in another world, one of their own. She thought about the bad gunky folks, the bloody bull folks. She thought about how when Jim Dooley had seen the long boy, he had stopped screaming and his hands had fallen to his sides, because the strength had run out of his arms. That was what looking at the bad gunky did when the bad gunky was looking back at you. "Scott," she said, "honey, I'm listening." There was no reply, except Lisi replied to herself. The name of the town was Anarene. Sam the Lion owned the pool hall, owned the picture show, and the restaurant where every tune on the juke seemed to be a Hank Williams tune. Somewhere, something in the empty study seemed to sigh in agreement. Possibly it was just her imagination. In any case, it was time. Lisi didn't know exactly what she was looking for, but she thought she'd know it when she saw it. Surely she'd know it when she saw it, if Scott had left it for her. And it was time to go looking, because she wasn't living long like this. She couldn't. She pushed play and Hank Williams' tired, jolly voice began to sing. Goodbye, Joe, me gotta go, me oh my oh. Me gotta go, pull the pirogue down the bayou.
Sowiza, baby love, she thought, and closed her eyes. For a moment the music was still there, but hollow and oh so distant, like music coming down a long corridor, or from the throat of a deep cave. Then sunshine boomed red on the inside of her eyelids, and the temperature dropped 20 or even 25 degrees all at a go. A cool breeze, delicious with the smell of flowers, caressed her sweaty skin and blew her sticky hair back from her temples. Lisi opened her eyes in Booyah Moon.
10. She was still sitting cross-legged, but now she was on the edge of the path leading down the purple hill in one direction and under the sweetheart trees in the other. She'd been here before. It was to this exact spot that her husband had brought her before he was her husband, saying there was something he wanted to show her. Lisi got to her feet, pushing her sweat-dampened hair away from her face, relishing the breeze. The sweetness of the mixed aromas it carried, yes, of course, but even more, the coolness of it. She guessed it was mid-afternoon, the temperature a perfect 75 degrees. She could hear birds singing, perfectly ordinary ones by the sound, chickadees and robins for sure, probably finches and maybe a lark for good measure, but no awful laughing things in the woods. It was too early for them, she supposed. No sense of the long boy either, and that was the best news of all. She faced the trees and turned on her heels in a slow half-circle. She wasn't looking for the cross, because Dooley had gotten that stuck in his arm and then thrown it aside. It was the tree she was looking for, the one that stood just a little forward of the two others on the left side of the path. No, that's wrong, she murmured. They were on either side of the path, like soldiers guarding the way into the woods. Just like that, she saw them, and a third standing a little in front of the one on the left. The third was the biggest, its trunk covered with moss so dense it looked like fur. At its base, the ground still looked a little sunken. That was where Scott had buried the brother he had tried so hard to save. And on one side of that sunken place, she saw something with huge hollow eyes staring at her from the high grass. For a moment she thought it was Dooley, or Dooley's corpse, somehow reanimated and come back to stalk her. But then she remembered how, after clubbing Amanda aside, he'd stripped off the useless, lensless night vision goggles and thrown them aside. And there they were, lying beside the good brother's grave. It's another bool hunt, she thought as she walked toward them. From the path to the tree, from the tree to the grave, from the grave to the goggles. Where next? Where now, baby love? The next station turned out to be the grave marker, with the horizontal cross piece turned askew so it was like clock hands pointing to 7:05. The top of the vertical was stained to a depth of 3 inches with Dooley's blood, now dried to the maroon, not quite varnish color of the stains on the rug in Scott's study. She could still see Paul printed on the cross piece, and as she lifted it, with real reverence, out of the grass for a closer look, she saw something else as well. The length of matted yellow yarn that had been looped repeatedly around the vertical slat of the cross, then tied firmly. Tied, Lisi had absolutely no doubt, with the same sort of knot as the one that had secured Chucky G's bell to the tree in the woods. The yellow yarn, which had once come spinning off Goodma's knitting needles as she sat watching television at the farm in Lisbon, was wrapped around the vertical just above the place where the wood was stained dark with earth. And looking at it, she remembered seeing it running into the dark just before Dooley pulled the cross out of his arm and flung it away. It's the African, the one we dropped by the big rock above the pool. He came back later, sometime later, got it, and brought it here. Unraveled some of it, tied it to the cross, then paid out more. And expected me to find the rest at the end of it all. Heart pounding hard and slow in her breast, Lisi dropped the cross and began following the yellow thread away from the path and along the edge of the fairy forest, paying it through her hands as the high grass whispered against her thighs and the grasshoppers jumped and the lupin gave up its sweet scent. Somewhere a locust sang its hot summer song, and in the woods a crow. Was it a crow? It sounded like one, a perfectly ordinary crow, called a rusty hello, but there were no cars, no airplanes,
no human voices near or far. She walked through the grass, following the line of unknitted Afghan, the one in which her sleepless, frightened, failing husband had swaddled on so many cold nights 10 years before. Ahead of her, one sweetheart tree stood out a bit from its fellows, spreading its branches, making a pool of inviting shade. Beneath it, she saw a tall metal wastebasket and a much larger pool of yellow. The color was dull now, the wool matted and shapeless, like a large yellow wig that has been left out in the rain, or perhaps the corpse of a big old tomcat. But Lisi knew it for what it was as soon as she saw it, and her chest began to hitch. In her mind, she could hear the swinging Johnsons playing "Too Late to Turn Back Now," and feel Scott's hand as he led her out onto the floor. She followed the line of unraveled yellow yarn under the sweetheart tree and knelt beside what little remained of her mother's wedding present to her youngest daughter and her youngest daughter's husband. She picked it up, it and whatever lay inside it. She put her face against it. It smelled damp and moldy, an old thing, a forgotten thing, a thing that smelled now more of funerals than of weddings. That was all right. That was just as it should have been. She smelled all the years it had been here, tied to Paul's grave marker and waiting for her, something like an anchor. 11. A little time later, when her tears had stopped, she put the package, for surely that was what it was, down where it had been and looked at it, touching the place where the yellow yarn unraveled from the shrunken body of the Afghan. She marveled that the line hadn't broken, either when Dooley fell on the cross, or when he tore it out of his arm, or when he flung it away, when he slang it forth. Of course, it helped that Scott had tied his string to the bottom, but it was still pretty amazing, especially when you considered how long this damn thing had been out here, exposed to the elements. It was a blue-eyed miracle, so to speak. But of course, sometimes lost dogs came home. Sometimes old strings held and led you to the prize at the end of the bull hunt. She started to unwrap the faded, matted remains of the Afghan, then looked into the wastebasket instead. What she saw made her laugh ruefully. It was nearly full of liquor bottles. One or two looked relatively new, and she was sure the one on the very top was, because there had been no such thing as Mike's Hard Lemonade 10 years ago. But most of the bottles were old. This was where he'd come to do his drinking in 96. But even blind drunk, he'd had too much respect for Buyamun to litter it up with empty bottles. And would she find other caches if she took the time to look? Maybe. Probably. But this was the only cache that mattered to her. It told her that this was where he'd come to do the last of his life's work. She thought she had all the answers now, except for the big ones, the ones she'd actually come for. How she was supposed to live with the long boy, and how she was supposed to keep from slipping over here to where it lived, especially when it was thinking of her. Perhaps Scott had left her some answers. Even if he hadn't, he'd left her something. And it was very beautiful under this tree. Lisi picked up the African again and felt it the way she'd once felt her Christmas presents as a girl. There was a box inside, but it didn't feel a bit like Goodma's cedar box. It was softer than that, almost mushy, as if, even wrapped in the African and left under the tree, moisture had seeped in over the years. And for the first time, she wondered how many years they were talking about here. The bottle of hard lemonade suggested not very many. And the feel of the thing suggested... "It's a manuscript box," she murmured. "One of his hard cardboard manuscript boxes." Yes, she was sure of it. Only after 2 years under this tree, or three, or four, it had turned into a soft cardboard box. Lisi began to unwrap the Afghan. 2 turns were enough to do the job. That was all that was left. And it was a manuscript box, its light gray color darkened to slate by seeping moisture. Scott always put a sticker on the front of his boxes and wrote the title there. The sticker on this one had pulled loose on both sides and curled upward. She pushed it back with her fingers and saw a single word in Scott's strong, dark printing. Lisi. She opened the box. The pages inside were lined sheets torn from a notebook. There were perhaps 30 in all, packed tight with quick dark strokes from one of his felt-tip pens. She wasn't surprised to see that Scott had written in the present tense, that what he had written seemed couched in occasionally childish prose, and that the story seemed to start in the middle. The last was true, she reflected, only if you didn't know how two brothers had survived their crazy father, and what had happened to one of them, and how the other couldn't save him. The story only seemed to start in the middle if you didn't know about Gomers and Goners and the Bad Gunky. It only started in the middle if you didn't know that...
12. In February, he starts looking at me funny, out of the corners of his eyes. I keep expecting him to yell at me or even whip me out of his old pocket knife and carve on me. He hasn't done anything like that in a long time, but I think it would almost be a relief. It wouldn't let the Bad Gunky out of me because there isn't any. I saw the real Bad Gunky when Paul was chained up in the cellar, not Daddy's fantasies of it, and there's nothing like that in me. But there's something bad in him, and Cutting doesn't let it out. Not this time, although he's tried plenty. I know. I've seen the bloody shirts and underpants in the wash. In the trash, too. If Cutting me would help him, I'd let him, because I still love him. More than ever since it's just the two of us. More than ever since what we went through with Paul. That kind of love is a kind of doom, like the Bad Gunky. Bad Gunky's strong, he said. But he won't cut. One day I'm coming back from the shed where I sat for a little while to think about Paul, to think about all the good times we had rolling around this old place, and Daddy grabs me and he shakes. You went over there, he shouts in my face, and I can see that however sick I thought he was, it's worse. He's never been as bad as this.
Why do you go over there? What do you do over there? Who do you talk to? What are you planning?
All the time shaking me and shaking me, the world tipping up and down. Then my head hits the side of the door, and I see stars and I fall down there in the doorway, with the heat of the kitchen on my front and the cold of the dooryard on my back. No, Daddy, I say, I didn't go anywhere, I was just... He bends over me, his hands on his knees, his face down in my face, his skin pale except for two balls of color high up on his cheeks, and I see the way his eyes are going back and forth, and I know that he and Wright aren't even writing letters to each other anymore. And I remember Paul saying, Scott, you doesn't ever cross Daddy when he's not right.
Don't you tell me you didn't go nowhere, you lying little motherfucker. I've been all over this mother-smocking house.
I think to tell him I was in the shed, but I know that will make things worse instead of better. I think of Paul saying you doesn't cross him when he's not right, when he's getting in the bad. And since I know where he thinks I was, I say yes, Daddy, yes. I went to Booyah Moon, but only to put flowers on Paul's grave. And it works. For then, at least. He relaxes. He even grabs my hand and pulls me up and then brushes me off, as though he sees snow or dirt or something on me. There isn't any, but maybe he does see it. Who knows? He says,
Is it all right, Scoot? Is his grave all right? Nothing been at it, or at him?
Everything's fine, Daddy, I say. He says,
There are Nazis at work, Scooter. Did I tell you? I must have. They worship Hitler in the basement. They have a little ceramic statue of the bastard. They think I don't know.
I'm only 10, but I know Hitler's been one dead dog since the end of the Second World War. I also know that nobody from U.S. Jip'em is worshipping even a statue of him in the basement. I know a third thing as well, which is never to cross Daddy when he's in the Bad Gunky, and so I say, what will you do about it? He leans close to me, and I think he's going to hit me this time, sure, at least start shaking me again. But instead he fixes his eyes on mine. I've never seen him so big or so dark, and then he grabs hold of his ear.
What's this, Scooter? What's it look like to you, old Scoot?
Your ear, Daddy, I say. He nods, still holding his ear, and still holding my eyes with his. All these years later, I still see those eyes in my dreams sometimes.
I'm gonna keep it to the ground, he says. And when the time comes,
he cocks his finger and makes shooting motions.
Every smuckin' one, Scooter, every sweet mother Nazi in the place.
Maybe he would have done it. My father, out in a blaze of rancid glory. Maybe there would have been one of those news stories. Pennsylvania recluse goes on rampage, kills 9 co-workers, self, motive unclear. But before he can get around to it, the Bad Gunky takes him in a different way.
February has been clear and cold, but when March comes in, the weather changes and Daddy changes with it. As the temperatures rise and the skies cloud over and the first sleety rains start to fall, he grows morose and silent. He stops shaving, then showering, then cooking our meals. There comes a day, maybe a third of the way through the month, when I realize that the 3 days off work he sometimes gets because of the swing shift have stretched to 4, then 5, then 6. Finally, I ask him when he's going back. I'm scared to ask him, because now he spends most of his days either upstairs in his bedroom or downstairs lying on the sofa listening to country music on WWVA out of Wheeling, West Virginia. He hardly ever says anything to me in either place, and I see his eyes going back and forth all the time now, as he looks for them, the bad gunky folks, the bloody bull folks. So, no, I don't want to ask him, but I have to. Because if he doesn't go back to work, what will happen to us? 10 is old enough to know that with no money coming in, the world will change.
You want to know when I'm going to go back to work, he says in a thoughtful tone of voice.
Lying there on the sofa with beard stubble all over his face. Lying there in an old fisherman's sweater and a pair of dickies and his bare feet poking out. Lying there while Red Savine sings Giddy Up Go out of the radio. Yes, Daddy. He gets up on one elbow and looks at me, and I see then that he is gone. Worse, that something is hiding inside him, growing, getting stronger, biding its time.
You want to know when I'm going back to work.
I guess that's your business, I say. I really just came in to ask if I should put on the coffee. He grabs my arm, and that night I see dark blue bruises where his fingers dug into me. 4 dark blue bruises in the shape of his fingers.
Want to know when I'm going there.
He lets go and sits up. His eyes are bigger than ever, and they won't stay still. They jitter in their sockets.
I ain't never gonna go there no more, Scott. That place is closed. That place is all blowed up. Don't you know anything, you dumb little glue-foot motherfucker?
He looks down at the dirty living room carpet. On the radio, Red Sovine gives way to Ferlin Husky. Then Daddy looks up again. And he is Daddy, and he says something that almost breaks my heart.
You may be dumb, Scooter, but you're brave. You're my brave boy. I'm not gonna let it hurt you.
Then he lies back on the couch again and turns his face away and tells me not to bother him anymore. He wants to take a nap. That night I wake up to the sound of sleet ticking off the window, and he's sitting on the side of my bed, smiling down at me. Only it's not him smiling. There's almost nothing in his eyes but the bad gunky. Daddy, I say, and he says nothing back. I think he's gonna kill me, gonna put his hands around my neck and choke me, and everything we went through, all that with Paul, it would have been for nothing. But instead he says in a kind of strangled voice,
"Go back, sleep,"
and gets up off the bed, and walks out in this kind of herky-jerky way, with his chin leading and his ass wagging, like he's pretending to be a drill sergeant in a parade or something. A few seconds later, I hear this terrible meat crash, and I know that he's fallen downstairs, or maybe even threw himself down, and I lie there a while, not able to get out of bed, hoping he's dead, hoping he's not, wondering what I'll do if he is, who'll take care of me, not caring. Not knowing what I hope for the most. Part of me even hopes he'll finish the job, come back and kill me. Just finish the job, end the horror of living in that house. Finally, I call out, "Daddy, are you all right?" For a long time, there's no answer. I lie there listening to the sleet, thinking, he's dead. He is. My daddy's dead, and I'm here alone. And then he bellows out of the dark from down below.
"Yes, all right. Shut up, you little shit. Shut up unless you want the thing in the wall to hear you, and come out and eat us both alive. Or do you want it to get in you like it got into Paul?"
I don't say anything to that. just lay there shaking.
"Answer me," he bawls. "Answer, Nummy, or I'll come up there and make you sorry."
But I can't. I'm too scared to answer. My tongue is nothing but this tiny hunk of dried up beef jerky lying on the bottom of my mouth. I don't cry either. I'm even too scared to do that. I just lie there and wait for him to come upstairs and hurt me, or dead dog kill me. Then, after what seems like a very long time, at least an hour, although it couldn't have been more than a minute or two, I hear him mutter something that might have been, "My fucking head's bleeding," or "It won't ever stop sleeting." Whatever it is, it's going away from the stairs and toward the living room, and I know he'll climb on the sofa and go to sleep there. In the morning, he'll either wake up or he won't, but either way, he's done with me for tonight. But I'm still scared. I'm scared because there is a thing. I don't think it's in the wall, but there is a thing. It got Paul, and it's probably gonna get my daddy, and then there's me. I've thought about that a lot, Lacey. 13. From her place under the tree, actually sitting with her back against the tree's trunk, Lacey looked up, almost as startled as she would have been if Scott's ghost had hailed her by name. In a way, she supposed that was just what had happened, and really, why should she be surprised? Of course he was talking to her. Her and no one else. This was her story, Lacey's story, and even though she was a slow reader, she had already worked her way through a third of the handwritten notebook pages. She thought she'd finish long before dark. That was good. Booyah Moon was a sweet place, but only in the daylight. She looked back down at his last manuscript and was again amazed that he had lived through his childhood. She noted that Scott had lapsed into the past tense only when addressing her, here in her present. She smiled at that and resumed reading, thinking if she had one wish, it would be to fly to that lonely kid on her highly hypothetical flower sack magic carpet and comfort him, if only by whispering in his ear that in time the nightmare would end, or at least that part of it. 14. I've thought about that a lot, Lacey, and I've come to two conclusions. First, that whatever got Paul was real, and that it was a kind of possessing being that might have had some perfectly mundane basis, maybe even viral or bacteriological. Second, it was not the long boy, because that thing isn't like anything we can understand. It's its own thing, and better not thought of at all, ever. In any case, our hero, little Scott Landon, finally goes back to sleep, and in that farmhouse out in the Pennsylvania countryside, things go on as they had been for yet a few days longer, with Daddy lying on the couch like a ripe and smelly cheese, and Scott cooking the meals and washing the dishes, only he says washing the dishes, and the sleet ticking off the windows and the country sounds of WWVA filling the house, Donna Fargo, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, Conway Twitty, Country Charlie Pride, and, of course, Old Hank. Then one afternoon around 3 o'clock, a brown Chevrolet sedan with U.S. gypsum printed on the sides comes up the long driveway, sending out fans of slush on either side. Andrew Landon spends most of his time on the living room couch now, sleeps on it at night, and has been lying on it all day, and Scott would never have guessed the old man could still move as fast as he does when he hears that car, which is clearly not the postman's old Ford truck or the meter reader's van. Daddy is up in a flash and at the window that looks out on the left side of the front porch. He's bending over with the dirty white curtain twitched a little to one side. His hair is standing up in the back, and Scott, who is standing in the kitchen doorway with a plate in one hand and a dish towel over his shoulder, can see the big puffy purple place on the side of Daddy's face where he fell down the stairs that time, and he can see how one leg of Daddy's Dickies is hoiked up almost to the knee. He can hear Dick Curless on the radio singing Tombstone Every Mile, and he can see the murder in Daddy's eyes and in the way his lips are pulled down so his lower teeth show. Daddy whirls from the window, and the leg of his pants falls back down into place, and he strides across to the closet like a crazy scissors and opens it just as the engine of the Chevrolet stops and Scott hears the car door open out there.